It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk to a reporter in Missouri about the protests happening there over the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager. Well, with September right around the corner, college students are starting their return to campus, and with that comes another year of college sports. And when football kicks off in a few weeks, the action on the field probably won't look any different than usual, but behind the scenes, it could be a whole new ballgame. Because of new reforms in the NCAA's largest conferences and a recent ruling by a federal judge, college athletes could be on their way to receiving additional benefits, including potential financial compensation from the licensing of athletes' names, images, and likenesses. Joining us now to talk about what's brewing in college sports is Welch Suggs. He's an associate professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. He's a former sports journalist and was the senior editor for athletics at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Welch, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
So in the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of news regarding the NCAA, and it sounds like you've been covering this beat for a long time. How big is this shakeup for the NCAA?
Well, you know, that's actually sort of a double-edged question. I would say, yes, this is the biggest pair of setbacks that the NCAA has had going back 40 years, actually, to a decision in 1984 that broke the NCAA's monopoly over college football on television. But at the same time, it's sort of amazing to see how powerful an institution college sports is, particularly if this is not something you follow every day. But the NCAA has been around since 1906, and the idea of amateur college sports, that is, athletes who play for their institution and not for pay, has been around that long and has been amazingly durable. And we still really don't know what the final outcome of either the O'Bannon decision or the NCAA's rules change on autonomy, to which you referenced, are going to be.
All right, well, let's talk about those two so we know what we're talking about here. In terms of athletes profiting from the licensing of their names, images, and likenesses, what do we know there?
Mm-hmm. So this is what's called the O'Bannon case. It refers to Ed O'Bannon, who is a star basketball player for UCLA going back almost 20 years. I think he's almost as old as I am. But he noticed his image and likeness being used in the EA Sports NCAA basketball video game, which may not sound like much, but he saw that his image was being used. He never received any pay for that and got to thinking about whether this was fair. He, along with a group of other plaintiffs and some very powerful antitrust attorneys, sued the NCAA, saying that their names, images, and likenesses, as the legal term is, should not be used without their permission, without compensation. And I guess it's almost 2 weeks ago now, Judge Claudia Wilkin in the Northern District of California ruled that they were right, that the NCAA could achieve all of the noble ideals it says come from hosting and promoting amateur sport without cutting off star players completely from compensation. So, as I said, no one knows exactly what this means, but it could mean that we see trust funds or something like that set up so that star athletes at places like Wisconsin-Madison could eventually benefit from jersey sales and the other uses of their names and images and likenesses while they're in college.
Why does this fall under the antitrust jurisdiction?
Because the NCAA is a collection of universities. There's over 1,000 of them and about 300 at the highest level in Division I, including Madison, as I mentioned, Marquette, University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And the NCAA sets rules for how athletics are governed. Now, those rules are limited. As I said, the courts have found before that the NCAA does have the power to enforce national rules that govern all of college sports and the conduct of college sports, but not necessarily business deals. So that creates kind of a gray area in between the rules on the field, like how many yards you have to go to get a first down, and the business practices of college sports. And as you're probably aware, college sports has become a very big business. The number thrown around is about $16 billion a year in total revenue to the NCAA and its member institutions. So the stakes have never been higher, and this creates a lot of questions about whether athletes ought to share in the tremendous groundswell of revenue that's come in recent years.
Well, and you mentioned another setback, and earlier this month, the NCAA's Division I Board of Directors approved a plan to give the five most prominent athletic leagues the autonomy to provide extra benefits to their athletes. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Sure, and it's, I don't know that setback is quite the right word to use, but it's an interesting development in the history of college sports. The NCAA has traditionally tried to maintain a level playing field in its rules, especially around recruiting and the treatment of student athletes and the benefits that are provided for them, so that, in theory, an athlete would choose among a number of different institutions, a number of colleges and universities, based on the best fit academically, personally, socially. You know, the kind of decision I'm sure that you made when you went to college and the kind of decision I made when I went to college. But that has always been a bit hypocritical, because if you were an athlete with aspirations of playing in the pros, then you were going to make your decision largely on the basis of the school you think most likely to get you there or the best deal that you can get. So an athlete who wants to go to the NFL obviously is going to be much more likely to choose Wisconsin-Madison if he earns a scholarship there, as opposed to, I would say, Drake University. You know, no offense to Drake, but it's just not quite the football powerhouse. So what the NCAA's rules mean is that conferences are now allowed to change things up and unlevel the playing field even more than they already are, so that if the top institutions, like those in the Big Ten Conference, want to award scholarships that cover up to the cost of attendance or provide stipends or to provide more food to recruits or allow them to participate in separate academic programs that previously would be considered extra benefits. So I know Commissioner Delaney of the Big Ten has mentioned study abroad, but providing other opportunities to athletes, when a lot of those are available to lower-tier schools, schools that don't have the money of a place like Madison. But previously rules have forbidden the top schools from taking advantage of the resources that they have, at least openly. So this really creates more of a divide between the haves and the have-nots, and the haves being the Big Ten, the SEC, the Atlantic Coast Conference, the Pac-12 Conference, and the Big 12 Conference, excuse me.
Now, where did that ruling come from? What was the legal basis for it?
That wasn't a ruling. That was merely a rules change by the NCAA's Division I Board of Directors. And all it really says is that the different conferences have the autonomy to make their own rules as regards recruiting and benefits and other provisions for athletes. So there's not a law being challenged in this case. It's merely a rule internally with the NCAA.
Gotcha. So how does this change, do you think, the recruiting processes going forward? You know, if you're Drake University, how are you supposed to stay competitive?
Well, it sort of begs the question of whether Drake was ever competitive with the Big Ten Conference schools, for example, or the Mid-American Conference schools is probably the better example of places like Central Michigan or Western Michigan or Eastern Michigan. How are they supposed to compete with Ann Arbor for recruits? Well, it does make it even that much harder, and it makes it that much less likely that athletes with NFL potential are likely to go to those schools. So really what it does, Veronica, I think most of all, is just lay bare the differences between these kinds of schools in ways that have been avoided in the past.
Not only that, but does it preference particular sports, college football and basketball, for example?
Well, that's the biggest fear, of course, is that this is going to create even more of an arms race in those sports to recruit the best athletes, especially for the schools within the Big Five conferences that don't make as much money as the others. Think of Indiana or Purdue as compared to Wisconsin or Michigan or Ohio State. Or down where I am, think of Mississippi State or Vanderbilt compared to Alabama or Georgia or Florida. And the concern there is that especially for schools with very large sports programs, and the Big Ten has historically had much broader sports programs. You have lacrosse, you have soccer, you have field hockey, you have synchronized swimming at some schools, that the cost pressures in the big-time sports to provide adequate packages to those athletes could result in fewer opportunities for athletes in non-revenue sports, and especially for female athletes. That's one of the big concerns, is that the progress that's been made under Title IX could stall out as a result of this ruling.
Could stall out. Could we also see potential lawsuits there?
It's possible. Moving back to the O'Bannon case for a second, that's been one of the really interesting questions of what Title IX basically says is that colleges have to provide comparable opportunities at the same level of competition. So, in theory, if you are going to have a football team where every athlete gets a $2,000 stipend and recruits, you know, stay at four-star hotels and this and that, then you ought to have a female sport that's privileged comparable to that. But that remains to be seen. Is that really going to happen? And if it doesn't happen, could that lead to more lawsuits? Now, Title IX, I mean, progress for women's sports, and this is, you know, totally beyond the scope of what you called ask about, has stagnated over the past decade or so for unrelated reasons. And so this seems like it could raise another set of fairness issues for female athletes.
We're talking now with Welch Suggs about the possible changes in the works for college sports. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Should college athletes be eligible for a piece of the NCAA's profits when their image is used? Maybe there's a video game character with their jersey number. Should they get some money for that? Seems like we're heading that way. And do you think paying players undermines the educational nature of college sports? Do you think this is the time to redefine college sports? And if so, what should they look like? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the future of the NCAA with Welch Suggs, professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Should college athletes be entitled to a piece of the NCAA's profits, or is the system currently in place working, do you think? And what other reforms might you like to see in college sports? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Welch, how do you think this affects the relationship between higher education and its goals of preparing students for a future career in the world and the goals of athletics?
Well, that's really the crux of it, and you got to that in a little bit with your lead out from the last segment, is what is a fair deal for college athletes and how should college sports work in the modern world of higher education? And, you know, the United States is unique in the world of doing a lot of its elite athlete development through its educational system. You know, if you go to the Europe or to Asia or Africa or South America, there's no other nation that tries to prepare elite athletes through their high schools and their universities. And it's been a very weird marriage for a very long time. And I think it's a historical marvel that it's persisted in the way it has. But what's really under threat now is this idea that college athletes ought to be unpaid amateurs playing for the love of the game. If you look through the NCAA's literature, if you look through the policies of college sports, they're all designed that way. But it's never really been that way. There have been athletes who have used colleges and used high schools even as training grounds for the pros since time immemorial. And is that such a bad thing? You know, we've invested a lot of infrastructure in making it happen that way. And whenever issues like this come up, you see a lot of ideas. You see people suggesting that maybe we ought to allow students to major in athletics, to major in sport preparation. Or you see other people on the other side who say that colleges ought to divorce athletics altogether or adopt something like a Division III model where there are no scholarships, many fewer opportunities, and much less pressure. And there are other models all around the world. You know, most nations have clubs that develop elite athletes, whether it's for sports like soccer or basketball, where kids will turn pro, you know, as early as 10 or 12 or 13 in some cases.
And do those kids generally end up going to school and getting college degrees?
Well, some do. You know, much few. I don't have stats in front of me. You'd have to look at UNESCO or something like that. But no, many fewer of them actually participate in higher education. But, you know, that's different. You know, we obviously have a different higher education system in this country where, you know, a lot more of our population is in the pipeline. But you know, I'll tell you one funny example. Back when I was at the Chronicle of Higher Education, our South African reporter did a story on the soccer team at the Wits University, the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, where the soccer team there actually played in the South African equivalent of Major League Soccer or the NFL. I mean, it was a professional team. Players got paid, and they could go on scholarships at the university if they wanted to. And the team's nickname was the Clever Boys. And I just thought that was an interesting allegory to say that, you know what, maybe there is nothing sacred about amateurism. Maybe we should allow athletes, you know, a chance to learn something about the world, but also prepare to play at the highest levels. And so there's all sorts of interesting things out there. And what will be very interesting is to see if colleges move in one of those directions to really divest from athletics because it either costs too much money, especially in the case of smaller schools, or because it doesn't work to have athletes who are obligated to be full-time students anymore. And so either of those is possible.
Yeah, the amateurism question is interesting. I want to come back to that. But first, let's take a call from Caleb in Lancaster. Hi, Caleb.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
I'm just curious because I do believe that if you bring money into the equation, that it's going to corrupt the system. It's going to corrupt the kids. It's going to change their views on college football. And I just think that it's going to hurt it. It's going to hinder the system. I don't see why if the NCAA is making money off of these kids, why can't they take a portion of each sale, of each jersey sale or whatever it may be, and either donate it or send it right back to the program or set up scholarships for kids that, you know, that aren't available to make those payments and stuff like that for school. So.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Caleb. That's an interesting perspective there. Maybe the NCAA shouldn't be profiting so much, you know, never mind giving it back to the athletes. Maybe they should feed it back into the program, or there should be some different monetary model there. What do you think, Welch?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you look at the largest growth in expenses in college sports, it's salaries and facilities. So what happens with all that money that schools generate, that conferences generate from their TV contracts, and that the NCAA generates, is it all goes into paying more money for coaches and building new facilities to try to entice recruits. So to the caller's point, money has always been part of it. Money has always been a dividing factor between what we call the haves and the have-nots, the schools that can actually sustain money and those that have to depend on their institutions to subsidize them to stay in business, essentially. And so it's an interesting idea, but, you know, who are you going to get that money from? Are you going to turn to the football and basketball coaches and say, okay, we're going to pay you $1.5 million and we're going to put this other $500,000 here back into a university or into something else? So it's a great idea, but I think the money is already there, and the question is more how it should be allocated.
Now, getting back to that question of amateurism, does that mean that argument is being sort of slowly but unforgivably chipped away at, and then it's not going to hold much water anymore, that fuzzy line between pro athletes and amateur athletes in college?
I think it has to a certain degree, but again, you know, I think what both of these decisions do is lay bare the situation that's always been there. You know, kids who are elite athletes, who are called 3-star, 4-star, 5-star recruits, are making decisions based on their sport. And even if they're not getting a paycheck, they're making decisions where they think they're going to get playing time, where they think they're going to be able to be stars and attract the notice of teams on draft day. And coaches are making the same decisions based on kids they think will help them win games and preserve their jobs and compete again for those higher paychecks. And then what's even more concerning from my standpoint is the way you see the practices in the high-profile sports like football and basketball kind of migrate to other sports, to Olympic sports and non-revenue sports. So you see them, if they can't recruit the talent in their own states to be competitive, they'll start recruiting internationally or in other places. Or they'll start demanding the same kinds of facilities or treatment that they see football and basketball coaches getting. And while no one's paying the tennis coach as much as they're paying the basketball coach, still, you see elements of that trickling down for the places that can afford it, and that puts even more pressure on the system. So I think this may sound really cynical, Veronica, but I just don't think amateurism has really been part of the equation for a very long time. Now, having said that, college athletes, you know, being a college athlete is a great experience, even with these pressures. I was a Division III athlete. I teach athletes every semester here at the University of Georgia. And they're good kids, and they work hard, and like the cliche goes, most of them are going pro in something other than sports. But they do recognize and they do see that college sports is a business, and both regular students and athletes see that. And so I think it's dangerous to assume that that is not otherwise the case.
We're going to leave it there. Welch, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me. I sure appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Welch Suggs, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Georgia. We've got a link to his piece, An Opportunity to Redefine College Sports, on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear from a young person's musical performance group from Wisconsin that's been touring the state all summer. First, we're getting the latest news from on the ground in Missouri. Governor Jay Nixon ordered the National Guard to Ferguson because of continued violent protests. Earlier this month, a white police officer shot and killed an unarmed black teenager named Michael Brown in the predominantly black city on the outskirts of St. Louis. Last night and early this morning, some protesters shot at police, looted businesses, and threw Molotov cocktails. Protesters have come up against a heavy police presence, causing nightly clashes of violence. Governor Nixon's office said there were what he called pre-planned acts of aggression in his request for the National Guard. Here to give us an update on what's happening in Ferguson is Jason Rosenbaum. He's a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jason, what's the mood like in Ferguson now after what's being called the worst night of violence?
Well, I was there earlier this morning, and it was relatively calm. Throughout the afternoon, I think there's been bits and pieces of activity. Primarily, the biggest development besides the National Guard situation was the unveiling of the private autopsy commissioned by Brown's family. I think generally, though, people are just kind of waiting and seeing. Last night was such an eruption of violence and discord that I think people are just hoping that, you know, tonight is a little bit more peaceful and quiet, though who knows really what the National Guard's presence will have on the protesters.
Now, you mentioned the autopsy results are in. This is from an autopsy requested by Brown's family. You also said protesters are waiting and seeing. What are they waiting for?
Well, I think that they're waiting and seeing to see if the officer that shot Michael Brown, Darren Wilson, ends up getting indicted or not. And that I think that in general, they want very quick action. They want to see him arrested. They want to see him put on trial very quickly. But in reality, the state and federal investigations that are going forward right now, they're going to take some time to complete. They have to get all the evidence together. They have to make sure they interview as many witnesses as possible. And I think as long as there's this gap between a decision on that and, you know, the time passes since Brown's death, it's just going to make people kind of more anxious and wondering what sort of conclusion is going to come from this entire situation.
Now, as far as the autopsy results go, what have we learned?
We learned that Brown was shot 6 times, including twice in the head. We learned that gunpowder residue was not found on Brown, which means that he likely was not shot from close range. It was revealed that from the person that did the autopsy, Michael Bodden, that some of the wounds, if they had just been by themselves in the arm and elsewhere on his body, may not have proved fatal. But when he was shot near the top of the head, that proved to be the wound that ended up killing Brown. I think that, you know, he stressed that it was a preliminary autopsy and he didn't have everything at his disposal that the state and federal entities that are doing separate autopsies had, like, for example, Brown's clothing. But for some in the audience, and there were at least, I think, 12 or 15 or 20 people who were watching this press conference, they saw this autopsy as more evidence that, you know, they wanted a quick decision on whether to indict indict Officer Wilson or not. And, you know, I think it just kind of confirmed what they had already believed.
Another finding, according to some sources, is that Brown was shot from the front, not from behind. How is that evidence being digested?
Well, you know, that, I think, evidence is kind of one of the key takeaways there. I think that there had been some initial reports that people thought he was shot from the back. One of the people that helped with the autopsy noted that it's possible that he was walking away and then maybe turned around and the bullet struck his arm, kind of in the motion of turning. But again, this autopsy doesn't necessarily tell exactly what happened. That kind of will be determined with the confluence of witness testimony and just other evidence that comes forward. It just basically provides some key facts, like how many times Brown was shot, which shot likely killed him, whether or not he was shot at close range, and just, you know, as you mentioned, where was he shot from? And being shot from the front, I think, gives some indication, but it doesn't give a definitive indication on exactly what happened.
On Huffington Post, there were some who were wondering whether this was an execution-style shooting.
I have not read that. I think some people have used that term. And by some people, I mean the people who are in Ferguson protesting and really kind of mobilizing after Brown's death. Again, it's probably important to note, as I mentioned before, that it's a preliminary autopsy done independently, and it will kind of be determined over time through these investigations whether or not that type of determination is true. But I don't think that all the facts are there to determine that yet.
So last night, police used tear gas, and protesters reportedly used Molotov cocktails. And news sites are reporting that children and families were there and were some of them caught in the middle. Who exactly are the protesters now in Ferguson?
Well, I think that generally it's kind of a mixture. I think that there is a group of protesters who are there. They're peaceful, they're determined, and they're not wanting to start any violence or trouble. And I think you see a lot of them when you go to Ferguson during the day, as I have many times. I think that there's also another element that sees these restrictions that are being placed upon the protests, either a curfew or maybe restrictions about where they can go, and they just see it as a chance to defy law enforcement to the point to where there's a confrontation. There have also been reports that there are just people there who are intentionally starting certain things. I haven't been able to confirm any of that, so I want to tread carefully there. But it has been reported elsewhere. So I think that generally when you talk with people who are kind of watching it from both inside and outside, it seems like there is an element that wants to kind of be confrontational, but it's definitely not the entire group. And that has been emphasized by the governor of Missouri, Jay Nixon, many times. It's been emphasized by many of the elected officials, both city and state, who are participating in the protests. And, you know, unfortunately, though, I mean, it exists. And until they decide to not kind of engage in stuff like that you mentioned, it's going to continue potentially to be a problem, basically.
Governor Nixon has called in the National Guard. What role will they be playing in Ferguson?
I think they're going to be playing a fairly supportive role. Everything that I've heard is they're just kind of guarding a makeshift command post of sorts that all the police are in Ferguson. I don't think that right now they're going to take like an active policing role, though. We don't know. I mean, it's the first day, and as we've seen over these last few days, things have changed pretty dramatically since Saturday when Michael Brown was shot. I mean, at first there was just a multitude of police that responded to the Sunday riots where the gas station was burned and places were looted. And then St. Louis County police were kind of taken out of commission after the Wednesday night of rioting. And the Highway Patrol, which is still in charge, basically, many people thought that they had things under control after Thursday, but things kind of went awry Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to varying degrees. And I think that it just became inevitable that the National Guard was going to be brought in. Now, I think it's just a great unknown how the protesters are going to react to something like that. You know, a couple people that I talked to today feel that it may kind of provoke that you know, unfortunate element that I mentioned within that movement to lash out further. But there are other people who think that they might just bring calm to this entire situation. I mean, so far today, it's been relatively calm during the day as it is during the day in Ferguson. It's just going to be tonight where we find out what this new element to security means.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in.
Thank you very much.
That was Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. What you're hearing is the Kids from Wisconsin's performance of the song Feel the Funk. The Kids from Wisconsin is a musical performance group that brings together musical talent from around the state and tours all summer long. As they prepare to kick off their final week, we've invited them to join us here on Central Time. And joining us from our studio in Milwaukee is Ashley Payton, soprano from Muskego, also Cody Anderson, baritone from Menominee, Wisconsin, and former Kid from Wisconsin and current board member Michael Sander. Guys, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Hi.
Well, it's great to have you all here. And Ashley, I'm going to start with you. Tell us, okay, who is in this group, Kids from Wisconsin?
It's a group of 33 of us, ages 15 to 20. We have 20 singer-dancers, so 10 boys, 10 girls, and then we have a 13-piece band. It's a wide range of high school students to college students and that sort of thing. So
you've got high school students and college students. It's an interesting mix. How did that come to be, Cody?
It's pretty interesting. I mean, everyone auditions. You have to be from Wisconsin. But it's an interesting time. I mean, we kind of forget about everyone's age because we're all around each other nonstop, either on a bus or we all live together in the Tommy Thompson Youth Center at Wisconsin State Fair Park. So we kind of forget about age. So, I mean, I'm the oldest in the group. I'm 20, and I don't feel like I'm the oldest in the group sometimes.
Wait, so you live together in a youth center at State Fair Park?
Yeah, there's a youth dormitory. I mean, obviously, girls stay in their own room, the guys stay in our own room. But yeah, we all stay there. Sometimes when we go off to a tour that's more than a few days, sometimes the host who has us at the show site will have us do homestays with families who volunteer to house some kids, or sometimes we'll stay at like a university dorm there that will donate the rooms for us to stay in or stuff like that.
That seems pretty fun living at the State Fair. Do you perform there quite a lot? Is that why that is your home base?
Yeah, State Fair is actually one of our biggest like performance times. We're there for the whole run of State Fair, so this year was 11 days. But we're there 2 times a day, and we also do our Kids Encore, which is kind of a little separate thing from the Kids from Wisconsin, which does like solos and trios and stuff like that we want to showcase ourselves. But that's like our main feature of where we do our summer is at the Wisconsin State Fair.
Well, Michael, let's go to you. How did the Kids from Wisconsin come into existence?
You know, it's a great story. The Kids from Wisconsin started in 1969. It was during the time when Governor Knowles, it was a turbulent time, we were at war, and Governor Knowles wanted to really feature and focus on some of Wisconsin's best things that they had to offer, which he thought were the youth. So that's how the Kids from Wisconsin were founded, through Colonel Mark Azalina, Governor Knowles, the Wisconsin State Fair Board. I know Wisconsin State Fair is one of our sponsors. And, you know, we really have been around. We want to seek out, train, showcase the musically gifted youth of Wisconsin in a manner that normally demonstrates outstanding talent, character, leadership. It's one of our greatest resources. It's our young people.
So this predates Glee. We can't look at you and say, well, this is part of the Glee effect. This has
been
around.
We are the original Glee.
Well, I want to hear some more of this. We're going to listen to a clip of one of your songs. I understand, Cody, that you're featured in this. We're going to play the clip Voodoo Daddy. Cody, what went into that one?
That's actually our dance feature called Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. It's our, out of my 3 years, that's my favorite dance feature that we've done. It's pretty intense. It's only 5 minutes long of dancing, but it feels like an hour.
Literally.
Everyone in the troupe can agree with that. It's an awesome, awesome dance feature. It kind of features everyone else in the troupe. We have, I believe, all 20 dancers dancing at one point. Our quartet that you just heard, they dance in it too. I mean, it's an awesome, awesome number. It's a lot of energy.
Ashley, what is it like being in a big group like this and doing this, you know, basically devoting your life to music and, in a sense, music theater, but all summer long?
It's a lot of fun. Obviously, a lot. We wouldn't be here if we didn't love to do what we're doing and didn't have a passion for it. So it's a lot of fun to be with like-minded individuals who love this experience and love music and have a passion for all of this as much as you do. And people who are also as, like, at the same caliber of professionalism and talent as you are. And so it's a very unique experience to really enjoy. And it's a lot of fun. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, definitely.
Do most of the kids from Wisconsin want to go on to have professional careers in music and theater?
Not all of us, but the majority of us do. I know there's a couple of kids in the troupe this year that one of them wants to be a marine biologist, another one wants to be a doctor. But individuals like me and Cody, for instance, I'm an acting major and he's a musical theater major. So the majority of us do want to pursue a career in music or theater or some sort of somewhere in the performing arts world. But no, not necessarily. You don't have to want to do this.
So. And Cody, do you feel like it does really give you the chance to hone your craft over the summer and do something fun at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I've learned so much in my past 3 summers of just being a kid from Wisconsin. That we kind of have the joke that kids' time isn't real time. A week with the kids is like 3 months in real time. it's pretty true, though. The people that they have on staff, Taras Naherniak and Carrie Hart and Jessica Foley, they are amazing people to work with. They teach us so much. And just being with the group and we learn how to go on tour and set up our equipment and actually be a touring group, it teaches us a lot about like perseverance and like just really focusing on ourselves and on each other and working together with a team.
And Cody, I understand this is your last year with the group. How are you feeling? Is it sad?
Yes, it is very, very bittersweet. I'm excited to like move on and maybe look at some other stuff.
And what does that mean? What will you be doing?
I'm looking at a few amusement parks, maybe Valley Fair or Six Flags. I'm looking at Holiday World in Indiana. But it's kind of sad. It's our last week with the kids, and so the emotions are kind of getting there, but yeah. Still focusing on the shows.
Well, maybe it's a good time to play a happy piece of music.
Absolutely.
That we just so happen to have right here. This is Happy by Pharrell Williams. Okay, well, hopefully that picked you up, Cody.
Oh, it did.
Michael, I want to go to you and say if someone, you know, is considering joining the Kids from Wisconsin, and you've seen it from a couple different angles as a board member, as a member of the group itself, what would you say that people come away from after they've joined it? What do they have with them?
Do you know, I realized as I get older how important this group was and all the learning experience that I got out of it and life skills. It wasn't just performing. Even though I went on performing professionally, you know, I honed those skills with the kids. There's just a lot of communication skills that you're going to utilize in all your life. Communication, learning to work as a team. I mean, it's a really educational, intense program beyond the music. You know, we always focus on the music, but as Ashley was stating before, not everybody goes into music. We're just really wanting to make well-rounded citizens, you know, who give back to the community. And I think we've been doing that for years, and I think we're going to continue that.
Do most people who are members of Kids from Wisconsin, do they go on to keep music in their life in some form, even if it doesn't mean performing every summer, but do they keep music in their lives?
I think so. I have a lot of friends from the past. You know, I was a kid from Wisconsin 20 years ago. There are some of those kids who are still performing professionally, whether they're on cruise lines or they are performing on Broadway. I mean, they go on to do great feats, but then there's some who take a step back, but music is always a part of their life. They may be in a band part-time. I know I like to still sing in the shower.
Well, that counts. That's fair. So what have you got on tap? You said this is the last week coming up. What performances do you have real quick?
Do you know, I really want to push we have a show tomorrow at the Stephanie Wheel Center in Sheboygan. You know, normally kids from Wisconsin are hired from different fundraisers for different companies or different schools, charities. But the kids from Wisconsin, we're doing our own show where we're actually underwriting it. It's in Sheboygan at the Wheel Center tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. And it's one of our fundraisers. It's one of our only fundraisers beyond getting our major revenue from our performance fees. So it's an exciting time. It's a great theater, and we're just excited to bring the show to Sheboygan, and hopefully we can build up our audience. There's a few seats left, so get out there and get some tickets.
Great. Well, I wish you all well. We've been speaking with Ashley Payton, Cody Anderson, and Michael Sander of the musical group The Kids from Wisconsin. They've been singing and dancing around the state this summer and are headed into their final week of performances. As we heard, they'll be at the Weill Center for the Performing Arts in Sheboygan tomorrow night at 7:30.